Matthew chapter 6, verses 22 and 23, Jesus makes the following observation. He says, "The eye is the lamp of the body. So then, if your eye is clear, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light that is in you is darkness, how great is the darkness?" Now, contextually here, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is emphasizing the focus of our life, right? This teaching, which to me has always seemed a little bit odd in trying to figure out exactly what Jesus' point is here, you'll notice that it's sandwiched between the familiar admonition in verses 19 through 21 about storing up your treasure in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroy nor thieves break in and steal, right? For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And immediately following this, he makes the observation, it's really a warning in verse 24, don't attempt to serve two masters, because either you'll love the one and hate the other, it's just not possible. You have to make a choice. Are you going to serve God, or are you going to serve mammon or things of this world? And so it would appear that Jesus is saying here, when he's talking about the eye being the lamp of the body, he's talking about make sure that you maintain a heavenly focus, right? Paul would say in Colossians chapter 3, the first four verses there, that we are to set our mind on the things above, not on the things that are on the earth, right? Keeping our vision clear, focused on the eternal reward of heaven, looking at the invisible, the eternal things, not looking at the visible, the temporal things that fade away. And when we do this, when we keep our focus clear, Jesus promises we'll be filled with the light. However, if we focus on this life, if all we're concerned about is the here and now, well, all we're going to find is loss and heartache and ultimately destruction and eternal separation from God. Indeed, how great the darkness. But perhaps there's slightly more to this statement of Jesus than just pointing out what we're supposed to be focused on generally. Notice that in this same context, Jesus is going to go on in verses 25 and following to address the problem of anxiety in life. Right? He says there in verse 25, "For this reason," and that phrase clearly connects what he's getting ready to say with these principles he's just laid out, at least in verses 19 through 24. "For this reason," he says, "don't be worried about your life as to what you'll eat or what you'll drink, or for your body as to what you'll put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing?" We all struggle with worrying about things of this life, with anxieties, with stresses, with problems. And Jesus says, don't worry about that stuff. And I find it interesting that this statement about the eye being the lamp of the body is in that same context. Let me suggest to you that when Jesus speaks here of the eye being the lamp of the body, he is also making a point about how we view the world around us. He's not just saying keep a heavenly focus, but while you're here in this life, be aware of how you view things, how you perceive things, how you look at the world around us. He's talking about our paradigm. That is the framework through which we view, conceptualize, interpret, and understand the world around us. The eye, as it is the physical member of the body through which much of our surrounding is taken in. Yeah, I get it. We have the five senses, right? We've got sight, smell, hearing, taste, and touch, right? Those are the five. I think I got all five of them. The reality is that much of our surrounding is taken in through our eyes. And not only is it taken in through our eyes, but the idea of seeing or viewing things is a great metaphor for how we look at life, how we look at things. The idea, the way that we see or view the world around us, it's going to greatly shape our responses and our actions, as well as our attitudes and our emotions. The problem that we run into, though, Maybe it's not a problem, it's just reality. The reality is that none of us possess a purely objective view of our surroundings. No one's paradigm through which they see the world is completely objective. Each of our perceptions, each of our paradigms is always shaded by our own personal past experiences, by our mindset in the moment, even by our mood, and by our physical comfort. You'd be surprised how much of a difference it can make in your perception of the world around you from the time that you're tired and groggy to when you're wide awake. You'd be surprised the kind of effect that whether you are healthy or dealing with a sickness has on your perception of life. Even something as simple as whether or not your belly is full or empty can greatly impact the way you view and interpret things around you. We each view the world and our circumstances, though, through our own unique paradigms. Well, what happens when our paradigm is warped or unclear or inadequate? Well, that's what I want to spend some time this morning talking about briefly, hopefully giving us some strategies that will help us to adopt a proper paradigm for life and our walk as God's children. But the first thing that we have to do is we have to identify our present paradigm. What color are your glasses? Think of it like this. Your paradigm is your own personal set of glasses through which you view everything around you. It's the lens through which you look, see, evaluate, and interpret your surroundings and everything within which you come into contact. And just like when we have bad eyesight and we need corrective lenses, right, actual real eyeglasses, it's pretty important that your prescription is an accurate prescription, right? That it matches the need of your eye so that you can see clearly, right? If I put on my dad's glasses, some Coke bottles, I can't see anything. Everything is blurry and fuzzy. Whereas if he puts on my glasses, everything's blurry and fuzzy. He can't see anything. It's because I need my prescription, he needs his prescription, because we're unique. But the same thing is true when it comes to our paradigm, the lens through which we view life around us. And so just like having correct eyeglass, the accurate prescription for your corrective eyeglasses, so too having a correct paradigm is important to clearly viewing, interpreting, and interacting with the world around us each day. I think one of the things that Jesus is trying to say here in this text is that if your vision is bad, your interpretation is going to be hindered or impaired, and therefore your response and your reactions will oftentimes be inappropriate or at best inadequate. Maybe they're just out and out wrong to the circumstances around you. So this idea of having a bad eye here, I would liken that to viewing the world through a negative, pessimistic, defeatist set of glasses. Everything is doom and gloom. And so when I look through those lens and see the world around me, I ought not be surprised to find that everything looks negative. The world around me is like seeing a cup half empty. All I see is what's not there, the negative. I tend to interpret everything in a worst case scenario. Whatever the worst possibility, that's surely what it is. That's surely what's happening to me right now. Everything is doom and gloom. And when we look at life this way, the challenges of life will most definitely seem insurmountable. They'll seem like mountains that are too high to traverse. They'll seem like giants who will surely knock us down and defeat us. However, if we would view the world with a clear eye, through a positive, optimistic, enthusiastic lens, well, life won't seem so depressing. And even when bad stuff happens, we'll see not the cloud, but the silver lining behind it. We'll see the cup is half full rather than half empty. We'll be hopeful and we'll actually be able to enjoy our life. Now, some may call this kind of a mindset or outlook, and I think rather pejoratively, oh, you're just looking through rose-tinted glasses, right? We've all heard that phrase before. As if it's unrealistic. Oh, you just have a rosy outlook on life. My question is, why is that bad? Usually it's the people who look through pessimistic glasses that want to label those who look optimistically at life that way. But I don't want to be guilty this morning of just oversimplifying this whole process. Or certainly I don't want to be dismissive to those who really are genuinely struggling with problems in their lives. Now, I don't want to just write it off and say, well, just think more positively about things and that'll fix everything, right? I mean, that's an easy, I think, almost a cop-out. Right? What if thinking about things more positively is not the only problem? You know, sometimes I think we address issues like this and we suggest that it's just your attitude that's the problem. If you'd stop having such a negative, pessimistic attitude about things and develop a more positive attitude, then you would see things better. But perhaps it's not just our attitude that needs to be adjusted. Perhaps it's also our perspective or the standard by which we measure things around us, the whole framework within which we think about our lives. Let me try to explain. Paul makes an observation in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. And in verse 12, and he's talking about some of his opponents who are presenting themselves as what I call super apostles. They're trying to make themselves look better than everybody else around them, certainly better than the apostle Paul, so as to gain a following for themselves. And notice what Paul says about these guys. He says, "We are not bold to class or compare ourselves with some of those who commend themselves. But when they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they are without understanding." Now, I would suggest to you that the principle that underlies Paul's point here is just as applicable to the way we view circumstances in our life. Oftentimes, it's not the attitude that we have that's wrong, but it's the standard by which we measure things in our lives. And if we're measuring things and weighing things and comparing things to the wrong standard, we're always going to come up with an answer, a mindset and interpretation that is devoid of true understanding. We have a bad tendency when it comes especially to problems or difficulties in our lives, to compare our problem to ourselves, to measure the magnitude of that difficult situation by the standard of me. And when we compare ourselves to the problem always seems overwhelming, especially if it's a real problem. Because the reality is that I am small and the problem is big. And so in comparison, it looks like a really big problem. And I would suggest to you the answer to overcoming this issue isn't just to think more positively, but to change our paradigm or our perspective, the framework within which we think about problems. Instead of seeing it as an us versus our problem, what we need to do is we need to start seeing it as our problem versus our God. And I think this is illustrated pretty clearly in a couple accounts from the Old Testament that I want to look at with you here this morning. In Numbers chapter 13 and 14, we have the account of the 12 spies being sent in to spy out the land of Canaan, the land that God had promised to give to the descendants of Abraham and Jacob. And now they have come out of Egyptian bondage and they're ready to go in and take possession of that land. But before they go into the land, God tells Moses to send some spies in to check out the land. And they're given a pretty precise, clear-cut mission. Notice in verse 17 of Numbers chapter 13, Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan. He said to them, go up there into the Negev, that is the southland, and go up into the hill country, that was up in the north. And he says, see what the land is like, whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether there are few or many. How is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? How are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps or with fortifications? How's the land? Is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land. So it's a pretty simple mission. Go into the land, do some reconnaissance, and I want you to know to take note of how does the land look? Is it a good land? Is it a land that's desirable to live in? Is it a fruitful land? If you can bring back some of the produce, go ahead and do that so we can see what the land is like. But also check out the inhabitants of the land. Are they weak or are they strong? Are they few or are they many? Do they live in kind of like tents and encampments, or do they have fortified cities with walls and armies? That was what they were supposed to do. So the spies go into the land and they spy out the land for 40 days. And they return after cutting down some of the fruit. The grapes were so big that they had to put it on a staff and carry it between two men. Give an indication of the fruitfulness of the land. We read in verse 25 that when they returned from spying out the land at the end of the 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to tell the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told him and said, we went into the land where you sent us. We're getting ready to give the report. Remember the two aspects they were supposed to spy out. First aspect, we went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. The land is good, guys. The land is plentiful. They describe it as a land that flows with milk and honey. It's got like an overabundance of good stuff there. This is where you'd want to live. Thinking, this is a good report. But then they get to the second aspect. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanite are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan. There's a lot of people there. And their cities are strong and fortified. And this idea that they saw the descendants of Anak there. Well, who are those guys? Well, those are some giant people. You jump down in the text to verse 31. The men who had gone up said, we're not able to go up against this people, for they are too strong. Notice this. They're too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out, the land is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. And we became, notice this, we became like grasshoppers in our own sight. And so we were in their sight. Do you see how they're viewing the problem, the obstacle in front of them? They're measuring it in comparison to themselves. When we compare the people of the land to ourselves, they're bigger than us. They're stronger than us. They're mightier than us. We are like grasshoppers in our sight in comparison to them. We're puny. We're weaklings. We can't do it. And in fact, they're ready to give up. They despair. Chapter 14 and verse 1. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried out, and the people wept that night. And all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into the land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? They want to appoint somebody to lead them back. What were they in Egypt? They were slaves. They were in bondage. But because they look at the problem in comparison to themselves, they say it's just too big. It's too great. We could never overcome. Moses, you basically let us out here to be slaughtered. Let's just go back to Egypt. The perspective of the ten was, we can't do it. The task is too big for us. But there were two spies who had a different perspective. Caleb and Joshua looked at the problem from a different angle. They didn't measure the problem, the magnitude of it, in comparison to themselves, but in comparison to the God that they served, who had promised them the land. You'll notice in the text in chapter 13 and verse 30 that Caleb tries to quiet the people before Moses. He says, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome." Now, why does Caleb think that they'll be able to overcome? Well, you get down into chapter 14 and you realize it's not because Caleb thinks he's so great. Notice in chapter 14 and in verse 6, Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes, and they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. The land is good, it's desirable. And if the Lord is pleased with us, he will bring us into the land, and he will give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey." Why? Because their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord God is with us. Do not fear them. Caleb and Joshua recognized that they weren't going to fight against these enemies all alone. The victory was not dependent upon their size and stature and physical strength, nor their military might, but rather it was because God was going to be fighting on their side. You know, it's interesting. In chapter 13, verse 1 and 2, it says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Send out for yourself men so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give the sons of Israel.'" Did you catch that? He says, send out some people to spy out the land that I'm going to give you. Caleb and Joshua believed that promise. If God said he's going to give it to us, it doesn't matter whether they've got a million giants or dragons or any other thing. It doesn't matter. Because God said he's going to give it to us. All we have to do is go in and take it. God will be the one who wins the battle. You see, they looked at the same problem from a different perspective. They measured the magnitude of the obstacle, not in comparison to their own tininess, but against the almighty power of eternal God. Another great story that illustrates this same point is one with which we might be even more familiar, the story of David and Goliath in 1 Samuel chapter 17. Here in this account, the Philistine army and the armies of Israel have gathered together on opposing mountains with a valley between them, and every day they're lining up in battle array, getting ready to go to battle. The Philistines are standing on their mountain. Israel's standing on their mountain with a valley between. And in verse 4 of chapter 17, we read, "Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath. And he was from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He also had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. And the shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam. And the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield carrier also walked before him." I want you to just appreciate for a second the size of Goliath. Now it says here in the text that he was 6 cubits and a span. Well, we don't measure things by cubits. Conservatively, though, he's a guy who's at least 9.5 feet tall. Okay? But he wasn't one of these like NBA 9.5 feet tall string bean guys who's, you know, can only reach up there and dunk the ball. He is a big man. Okay? And I know he's big because when we look at the armor that he's wearing, it's a lot of armor. In fact, it says that the chainmail, the scale armor, which would have just been like really the under armor, it says that it alone weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. Now, what in the world is a shekel of bronze weigh? We don't measure in those terms today. Well, from my research, what I found is that at minimum, just this scale armor that went underneath the rest of his armor weighed minimum 99 pounds. Probably more realistically, it weighed about 125 pounds. Okay? His spear is described as the size of a weaver's beam. We're talking about a rod or a shaft that's probably 10 to 12 feet long. Okay? And on the end of it is the iron spearhead, weighing probably 12 to 16 pounds itself. And it could have been an additional 24 to 26 inches long. So you're talking about a guy wielding a spear that is somewhere between the range of 12 and 14 feet long. And that doesn't include his bronze helmet. That doesn't include the bronze greaves that are on his shins. That doesn't include the sword that's slung around his waist. That doesn't include the bronze javelin that's slung around his back. You get the picture that this is a big guy. In fact, the fact that we're told here that he was from the city of Gath, it's interesting that in the book of Joshua chapter 11 and in verse 22, we're told that of the sons of the Anakim, the sons of Anak, remember, those were the guys that the spies were afraid of. Because why? Because they're giants. Because they're big dudes. Well, when they did come in and take possession of the land, they got rid of all of those guys, except for in three cities. And guess what one of the cities was? The city of Gath. And so here you've got Goliath, a son of Anak, of the Nephilim, a mighty warrior, a giant of a man, not just metaphorically, literally. And he comes out into that valley every day to taunt the armies of Israel. And notice his taunt, verse 8. He stood and he shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not a Philistine and you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him," and we all know that's what's going to happen, that seems to be what's implied here, "then you'll become our servants and serve us." And again the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Goliath's taunt is, "Look at me! Look at how big I am! Look at how strong I am! Which one of you chumps wants to come out and fight me? Measure yourselves and see who's brave enough. See who's strong enough. See who's mighty enough to take me on." That's the taunt. And the idea that he's defying the ranks of Israel, he's saying, "I don't believe there's anybody in there man enough to do it." And you know what? He was right. This taunting went on for 40 days, we read in verse 16. Can you imagine that? For 40 days, every morning you get up and you go stand in line, and Goliath comes out and he gives this same taunt. And every day you're looking around at your buddies on either side saying, wondering, which one of us could possibly take this guy down? And that seems to be the response, the perspective of the armies of Israel. They despaired. We read in verse 11, "When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." They were scared to death. Why? I would suggest to you it's because they were measuring the problem in comparison to themselves. Notice if you jump down in the text, We're kind of skipping over the part where David has arrived and he's asking some questions when he overhears Goliath's taunt. But notice in verse 24, when all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who's coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel." Their attitude is, "Have you seen this guy? Are you kidding me? Who could possibly take him on? He's too big. He's too strong. He's too experienced. He's too mighty." They were focusing on the problem in comparison to themselves and their own strength, their own ability, and their own power to overcome. And when they measured themselves against Goliath, they seemed tiny and puny. Maybe we might say, like wee grasshoppers in their sight. And indeed, when you look at things from a physical standpoint, they were. There wasn't a man, even Saul, who was a head and shoulders taller than the rest of the people, would have been dwarfed in comparison to Goliath. What are they going to do? It's interesting that even Saul buys into this. Notice once David has volunteered to go and fight Goliath, Saul tries to dissuade him from doing that. And we read in verse 33, "Then Saul said to David, 'You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. Why? For you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth.'" David, you're too young. David, you're too small. David, you're too weak. David, you don't have enough experience to take on this big of a problem. You can't do it. And indeed, if it was only up to David, that would have been the case. But contrast the way that the armies of Israel looked at the problem with the way that David looked at the problem. Jump back with me in the text to verse 26. Because David is observing for the first time Goliath's taunt, and he's seeing the despair on the faces of all the men in the army. And David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach of Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" I love that. David doesn't say that he should taunt the armies of Israel, but that he should taunt the armies of the living God. We're already getting a glimpse of the perspective at which David is looking at the problem. He's comparing the problem not to man's ability, but to God's strength. And so when you jump down in the text of verse 32, David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on account of him, for your servant will go and fight with the Philistine." And Saul says, "No, you can't. You're too small. You're too weak. You're too inexperienced." And David says to him, "Well, your servant was tending his father's sheep." This is verse 34. Your servant was tending his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him. I attacked him, and I rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard, and I struck him, and I killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them." Why? Because David was so strong? Because David was such a cunning warrior? No. Since he has taunted the armies of the living God. And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion, from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistines." And so Saul said to him, "Well, go and may the Lord be with you." Right? I kind of get that as kind of like a non-committal. "Well, go and may the Lord be with you." You know? He doesn't believe that, but David does. And that makes all the difference here. And so even though Saul tries to outfit David in his armor, and David says, "Hey, I can't fight in this. I haven't tested it out." He takes it all off, and he goes into battle with nothing but a staff and a sling and five stones from a brook. And we read in verse 41, the Philistine came on and approached David with a shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him. How is Goliath still looking at the problem? He's saying, "You compared to me? Are you kidding? You couldn't find anybody better than that." And so he says to him, after he looks at David, "He was but a youth and ruddy with a handsome appearance." The Philistine said, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine also said to David, "Come to me and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." Goliath says, "I'm going to whoop you. I'm going to whoop you good. Come on." But notice David's response. David said to the Philistine, I can't hardly read this without getting goosebumps. You come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of Jehovah of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day, Jehovah will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you, and I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, and all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that Jehovah does not deliver by sword or spear, for the battle is Jehovah's, and he will give you into our hands. Do you see the perspective of David? Goliath, you may think you're big, buddy, but my God is bigger than you. And he's the one who you're fighting against. You may think you're fighting against me, but that's not the case. The reality was Goliath was going to be fighting against God. David looked at the problem and measured it not in comparison to himself, but in comparison to his God. Goliath may have been a giant who dwarfed David, but Goliath became the dwarf in comparison to the Almighty God. And David recognized that the battle was not his to try to win alone, but it was God's battle to win. And this perspective, this paradigm, this set of glasses, this lens through which David evaluated the world around him made all the difference. While everybody else was frozen by their fear and their own inadequacies, David put his confidence in God. And God delivered and gained the victory through David. Verse 48, then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him, but there was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. Who really won the victory here? It was really God. David just happened to be the tool, the instrument, through which God delivered the victory. And I'm convinced it has a great deal to do with the fact that David put his faith in God rather than faith in himself to win this battle. Comparing our problem to the power and magnitude of our Almighty God, the problem will seem almost insignificant. Certainly, it will seem manageable. And we will be able to face it with courage and optimism. When we remember to measure things, especially our problems, in comparison to our God, knowing that it's not up to us, it's not dependent on our strength alone or our ability or our knowledge or our power to overcome, we can face just about any challenge, any temptation, any obstacle, any enemy, and gain the victory. Let me share with you just a couple verses. Jesus says in Mark chapter 10 and verse 17, with people it is impossible, but not with God. For all things are possible with God. Paul would admonish us finally to be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Where does the strength come from? Not from me. It comes from my God. Which is why Paul could say in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 13, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Nothing is too big for our God. I want to encourage us this morning to start viewing our lives through that lens, through that paradigm, and see if it makes a difference in how we view our lives.